Wake up, America. It's Morning Air with John Morales.
Si, senor.
Sarah Tafoya.
This is my mom.
Am I going to get paid for this?
And Glenn Leverins.
This is Morning Air.
That's how I know.
On Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for Morning Air here on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app. It is Glenn and Sarah in for John today. We've got a great show lined up for you as always as we inch towards St. Patty's Day at the end of the week. We'll talk about the spirit of St. Patrick in America. We'll do that with Joe Boland before the hour is through. We'll get the latest, not from Ireland, but Italy. How about that? Ashley Nerona from Rome coming up as well. We'll talk about that banking collapse out west as well. But first off, I want to check in with our very own button pusher and more. Good morning, Sarah. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Glenn. It's a beautiful morning.
Now, we get up really early. And so, you know, one thing that can help us enjoy living from day to day with getting up really early is sometimes that occasional nap later in the day. And today is a day to salute napping, possibly by getting a few winks sometime this afternoon, huh?
Oh, I would love to do that. And you know what? With a baby, they always need to take that nap. So it's nice to try to do that with them. But oftentimes it is hard for us as adults to kind of just let it go and take a little siesta, isn't it?
Well, it is. When it seems the younger we are, the harder it is. You know, when we get older, we begin to appreciate those naps. I can remember as a kid one time trying to be laid down for a nap with my mom, and she had some dumb soap opera on back in the day, and she fell asleep, and I was still awake. There was a time when the first baby was old enough to hear books, but was being entertained by my wife in the back seat on a long five-hour drive, and my wife fell asleep, and the baby was still awake. So the baby and I were awake as I'm driving. And so it doesn't always work out that we get the little ones to sleep, but the older we get, we seem to enjoy those naps a little bit more. Is that something, you know, with multiple kids, it's difficult, but I always say, like, when the baby naps, that's when you got to take advantage of it, huh?
Well, you know, experience will tell you that, yes, when you should follow this advice. I feel like when you're a first-time mom, you're just like, look, there's too much to do. I can't do it. Unless you're totally exhausted because the baby's been keeping you up all night. And then you kind of relent just because your body, you know, can't do anymore. But even with experience, I find it hard to remember to just stop doing stuff and take that nap. Sometimes your body gives you so many triggers, you just can't do anything about it. You have to take that nap. And man, do you feel good afterwards. And it's good to take that nap. It's okay. I think when you're, like you said, when you're a little kid, you kind of fight it. Oh, I don't need to take a nap. I'm missing so much. And then as you get older, you're like, what was I doing? I should have been taking a nap every day. You have so much more energy for the second half of the day. I mean, it doesn't have to be a very long nap, but it is a good thing to do if you are able to do it. So I recommend it. I don't always follow my own advice, but I try to do it whenever I can.
Hearty endorsement for naps this morning here to get you off to a flying start. You know, and sometimes I you know, getting up really early for radio, you're looking forward to that afternoon nap. But here's hoping you can enjoy the moment with us this morning because we have a lot to cover, including what's going on with the banking system right now. Here to tell us more about that, Chad Garcia with Ave Maria Mutual Funds. Good morning, Chad. Great to have you along today.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Well, we don't know if the folks running the bank were taking a nap or exactly what happened, but we're going to learn a little bit today about Silicon Valley Bank. What happened there? They weren't the only bank last weekend that had difficulty, and will there be more? Help us to understand stuff we don't normally think about unless we're right into that business, and it doesn't sound great, but the government helped out a little bit. So give us the latest, Chad.
Sure. So we had some big news late last week with the pending collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And that's a bank that's based out west and it serves the venture capital community. So startup companies that are often at the cutting edge of technology. The sector, the venture capital sector and the technology sector was hot, particularly for the last 5 or so years, which led to ample deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. And the bank had, you know, more money than they knew what to do with respect to lending it back out. And they took a bunch of those deposits and invested it in long-dated U.S. Treasury securities. And U.S. Treasury securities are risk-free, but by buying long-dated ones, that left them, it set them up to be in a bit of a bind as the Fed raised rates, you know, particularly when the Federal Reserve raised rates in such a dramatic fashion. And so when the Fed started to raise rates, the IPO market dried up. That's taking these venture-backed and tech companies public. That hurt the earnings of Silicon Valley Bank, is when they lend money to tech companies, they often take free equity in the form of warrants in them. And so that hurt their earnings. And then as the interest rates went up, some of their clients moved money out of deposits and into short-term treasury securities in an effort to get higher interest rates. And that caused a mismatch on the bank's balance sheet between their short-term liabilities, which would be the deposits, and their long-term assets, which would be loans, and in particularly the long-dated treasuries. And so to satisfy demands from their depositors for cash, they were forced to sell some of their long-dated treasuries. And these assets are risk-free, but if you hold them to maturity, you would get paid back. But as the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, they became less valuable if you had to sell them in the meantime. And so once the bank started to sell these long-dated treasuries, they had to realize losses. And then, of course, that spooked their depositor base. With social media these days, everybody found out about it pretty quickly. And that led to a good old-fashioned bank run where depositors rushed to get their capital out of the bank.
Which, Ed, was Silicon Valley Bank that unique that they became especially liable in a situation like this?
Well, they're definitely not a small bank anymore. You know, they're quite large, but not large enough to be deemed by the government to be kind of too big to fail. And but if you look at it being unique, it is unique in the sense that most of its deposit base is within the startup and venture capital community. And so that makes it somewhat unique. And the history goes back to, you know, several decades ago when this community was trying to get banked by the establishment East Coast banks who, you know, as an industry, this industry was just kind of too small for them to care about. And so, you know, there was a need by that community to be banked by bankers who understood the needs of startup companies. And so there's definitely a valuable franchise here. And, you know, it was somewhat unique. But what was troubling is that when Silicon Valley Bank had its bank run, depositors in other banks that are non-money centers or banks that are deemed to be too big to fail by the government, they started getting nervous as well. So if one bank that's pretty large could fail, you know, other banks that are, you know, potentially smaller could fail as well. And so we started to see some runs on some other banks, which caused the government to step in and backstop the deposits of all depositors. You know, previously, there was a $250,000 maximum that was insured by the FDIC. The government came in and basically insured everybody's deposits. And, you know, hopefully that level of insurance doesn't stick around. But I think the government deemed that necessary just to give some time to work this out.
And I'm sure those who had money there know all of that by now, but it took a day or two, you know, with the problems on Friday, and then by the end of the weekend, the government had announced that, but good news that those deposits were covered. Explain how that's different than actually bailing out the bank, but it's kind of bailing out the depositors.
Yeah, it's certainly bailing out the depositors. And I think the reason why the government did this for two reasons. Number one is that the depositors of Silicon Valley Bank are often these early stage, cutting edge technological companies. And you know, I don't think the government had the appetite to see a lot of these, a lot of our cutting edge companies where the new technologies were going to come out of go down because of this issue. And then the second reason was, you know, this looked like it was going to spread to all non-money center banks. And there's only a handful of very large money center banks, you know, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, et cetera. But there's over 6,000 banks in the U.S. And so that could have been a big issue if all of them, you know, started to experience bank runs in the coming weeks. Now, you know, how this differs from, you know, a bailout is that, you know, management is going to be gone. You know, they are primarily at fault for this issue. You know, managing your short-term liabilities and long-term assets, that's, you know, the first rule of being a banker. That's your primary job. The shareholders of the bank and likely the creditors of the bank, the lenders to the bank, are, you know, shareholders are going to be a zero. The lenders are probably pretty close to that, if not a zero as well. So it's not like there is not consequences for the bad decisions of management.
How about the second bank over the weekend that failed?
Yeah, that bank served ultra high net worth community. I mean, it was depositors that certainly could have withstood some heartache if the bank failed, but I think that they were deemed to be, you know, their depositors caught wind of what was happening at Silicon Valley Bank, and you know, signs of a classic bank run started to appear there as well. And so I think the FDIC and the Treasury were concerned about that spreading to other small banks, and you know, they took measures to secure up the confidence of the depositors. And for the most part, depositors believe that their money is going to be safe at banks. And, you know, while the limit had been $250,000 of deposits that are insured, you know, going back to the great financial crisis, you know, one wouldn't really expect the average depositor to be able to conduct a significant amount of due diligence on a bank just to deem if they're a kind of a creditworthy counterparty. Whereas the shareholders of a bank and lenders to a bank, you know, are certainly expected to be able to do their own due diligence to, you know, determine the creditworthiness of their counterparty.
Is there something in banking regulation? It seems in the last several years, since the kind of difficulties in 08, spurred on in large part by real estate situations, but there have been a lot of, you know, banks people hadn't heard of that are popping up, smaller banks, I don't know if they're called the regional banks. You know, it's like every other corner, suddenly it's, you know, Fred's Pretty Good Bank is opening up, compared to, you know, in the old days, it was a handful of large banks that had a million branches everywhere.
Right. The way the banking started out was it was a local business, and banks, you know, weren't allowed to have several branches or cross state lines, and you know, that changed, you know, a few decades or ago. So the history is us having a less amount of banks, like as these local banks either get consolidated up into a larger bank or go out of business. With respect to the regulation, there were certainly more regulations that were imposed on banks following the great financial crisis. And, you know, the problem there was banks having bad loans or bad assets on their balance sheet, as opposed to this issue where the assets were good. They were just the duration of them was mismatched with their liabilities. In 2018, some of that regulation was relaxed in an effort to relieve some pressure on smaller banks who didn't have the necessary income to live up to the regulatory regime. And that is getting, you know, there's, everybody takes a political crisis or a crisis and turns it into politics. And so that's getting a little bit of, those moves are getting a little bit of heat. But I don't think that any of the relaxed regulations would have caught what happened. I mean, this is simple asset liability matching. I mean, this is just part and parcel of being a banker. I mean, you can't regulate competency.
Maybe bottom line, Chad, is just to remind folks that you know, their money is safe. They might be worried a little bit, but there's no need, quite honestly, not with any political spin, but there's quite honestly no need to run down and suddenly start filling your mattress as opposed to your bank account.
Well, that's certainly true. The bank has guaranteed deposit base into an unlimited amount, and you know, I would like to see that go away, because if it doesn't, then banks will just become a quasi government utility. But you know, in the last, you know, regime where you were insured up to $250,000, I mean, that $250,000 is a healthy amount to keep in cash. And you know, if you have more of that, you can always put it into treasury securities or spread it around amongst a handful of banks, so that you don't have more than 250 at each one.
Being in finance in general, when you see something like this pop up, is it like, oh, wait a minute, we thought, you know, this went away in the 1930s, or at least in the 2008s, right?
Well, yeah, I've been seeing too many bank runs in my career, but if you, you know, like I said, there's over 6,000 banks in the U.S., and I was taking a look at it over the weekend, and coming out of the great financial crisis to about 2012, 13, 14, there was probably over 100 banks that failed each year, but these banks were, you know, pretty small and local banks, and, you know, banks that probably most people have never heard of. And then if you continue that out into 2022, there's maybe, I don't know, four or five banks that would fail a year, but these have got to be like very small local banks. You know, the Silicon Valley Bank was quite large, and, you know, it could have been a problem if it would have went down without some government assistance. Now, the bankers should have known better when the feds were raising rates that they may have had a problem with their long dated assets, and, you know, they could have made some adjustments, you know, throughout the last year. If you go back in history, when we raised rates so severely the last time, which was when Paul Volcker was the Federal Reserve Chairman, it caused some bank failures as well. And the banks that failed were the ones that were exposed to the oil industry, which was the then hot sector.
Chad Garcia with Ave Maria Mutual Funds. Chad, we have to run, not on the bank, just time for a break here. But before we go, how can folks get a hold of you with like more info?
Sure. They can give us a call at 866 Ave Maria, or visit us online at AveMariaFunds.com.
All right, with AveMariaFunds.com. There we go, with Chad Garcia joining us with some shedding some light on the banking situation today. We'll shed some light on Rome, find out what's going on in the Eternal City. Ashley Nerona joins us next, live from Italy, as Morning Air continues here on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
You want to get down? Tell me, what you going to do? Do you want to get down?
Bringing Rome to home. This is Morning Air
on Relevant Radio.
Well, the Italian music tells us it's time for our next segment here as we continue with Morning Air. Glenn and Sarah in for John today, checking in with our Rome correspondent, Ashley Nerona, live from Roma. Good morning, Ashley. Great to have you along today.
Buongiorno, Glenn. It is wonderful to speak to you today. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about St. Patrick's Day in Italy coming up just a little bit, and then maybe a little more even about St. Joseph's Day in Italy coming up a little bit. But I suppose it's always good to get down to business and see what our Holy Father is up to with his weekly general audience.
Yes, indeed. The audience was held in St. Peter's Square today with a nice warm 60 degrees. That meant that we were seeing some of kids jumping into the vehicle with the Pope and riding around the square, enjoying the sunshine. Although, actually, in many parts of Italy, cold weather has returned after a little taste of spring, but not in St. Peter's Square. And today, Pope Francis continued catechesis on apostolic zeal. So that, of course, has been his theme for the past few weeks. Today, he talked about service. So he asked the question, what is service? Well, he said it's when you listen and humble yourself and really put yourself at the service of others. He said that is what being an apostle, a Christian apostle, is really all about. So then he asked the question, what is an apostle? And he defined it by two important characteristics. The first, he said, is that an apostle is sent out for a mission. And so this aspect of apostleship is exemplified by the event in which the risen Christ sends his apostles into the world. So this is in John 20:21, when Christ told them, as the Father sent me, even so I send you. And then he said the second important characteristic of being an apostle is having a vocation or a calling. And he said that that is a feature of Christian life from the very beginning. And that's referring to 3:13, when Jesus called to him those who he desired, and they came to him. So Pope Francis went on to urge that all Christians receive a calling from, and he specified all Christians, meaning priests and religious and lay people, are called to mission. And that everyone has what he called a common calling. Yet within that, there is a diversity of ministry. And so with that, Christ conferred on the apostles and their successors the duty of teaching, of sanctifying, of ruling in his name and power. So that demonstrates that diversity of ministry. But same time, all laity, he said, share in the priestly, prophetic, and royal office of Christ. And then, Glenn, in the final section of the catechesis today, the Holy Father turned to consider what the Council, Second Vatican Council, meant when it talked about the collaboration of the laity and the hierarchy. He said that this is an important thing because we have to remember that the church has not really been founded and not really yet fully alive, nor is it a perfect sign of Christ among men, unless there is a laity worthy of the name working along with the hierarchy. So that comes from Ad Gentes, paragraph 21. So he stressed then the importance of this type of collaboration, looking at various documents from Vatican II, and of course, quoting from scripture today, reminding all the faithful and all who were there in the square of the importance of praying for that call to understand each of us to understand the way that the Lord is calling us every single day, Glenn.
Oh, yeah, that call, we always need to be listening for that. But that idea of cooperation, too, I mean, to have the laity mm-hmm. along with the clergy, the Holy Father has always been big about that, to not setting apart clergy more than they are set apart by the duties that they have. But also, you know, in many parts of the world, but certainly parts of the U.S. as well, where due to retirement and the like, the ranks are a little thin in priests. We need lay folks mm-hmm. to step up and do the things that they can. And maybe we can do a little more of that as well. Always appreciate the update on the Holy Father's general audience as we continue our discussion with Ashley Nerona from Rome this morning here on Morning Air. Today, as we look on the calendar, it's one of those semi-famous dates, the Ides of March.
Yes, indeed. Well, we all remember those famous words of Shakespeare from his play Julius Caesar, "Beware the Ides of March." And right in the center of the historical district of Rome, in a place called Largo, Argentina, in just about 30 minutes from now, Rome is going to mark the Ides of March, the remembrance of the assassination of Julius Caesar, with an historical reenactment. So this is, of course, remembering that fateful day back in 44 BC, and an historical dramatic society, it's called the Gruppo Storico Romano, they are going to recreate the assassination. Now, why they chose that particular area called Largo, Argentina? It's because the assassination occurred during a meeting of the Senate there in the Curia Pompeia within the larger Pompey Theater complex there in what is now Torre Argentina. But I have to tell you that most famously, people remember the Largo Argentina area as being home to a cat sanctuary amongst the ruins. So I think many of our listeners will say, oh yeah, I remember the cat sanctuary. But it is an archaeological area where this very famous historical event happened. And so today, the reenactment is going to recall those Senate meetings, those heated conversations that led up to Julius Caesar's murder. Now again, Julius Caesar had seized power from the Roman Republic, and he was to be declared dictator for life. So he was killed by a group of conspirators, even led by his friends, right? The famous Brutus and Cassius. And this all happened as he stepped into that theater of Pompey. He's said to have been stabbed 23 times. And so today, the reenactment is going to culminate with a funeral procession to the Roman Forum, because he was cremated in the Roman Forum. And then it will conclude at the Temple of Divus Iulius, which is where the crematorium is, where his remains, of course, were burned. And so in that very spot, you will find for the next week, Romans will come and they will place flowers and laurel wreaths, etc., in commemoration of this very famous date, Glenn.
Well, that's something you can do when you live in a country with a lot of history. We think how far we might go mm-hmm. back for our town festival and celebrating someone from the 1880s, and look at what Rome can do. Yeah, I was still thinking about the term cat sanctuary there as well. It reminded me of a minor league baseball team in St. Paul, Minnesota, that would always do goofy things at the ballpark, and they had a cat video festival 1 year, and this had expanded from a smaller theater to like an 8,000-seat baseball stadium. And the MC famously mentioned, yeah, we got a great crowd here tonight to watch these videos on the big screen with 8,000 of you. But that means at home right now, there are 87,000 cats all by themselves. And so
there you go. Well, if they came to Rome, they would find refuge there in the cat sanctuary.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, St. Patrick's Day coming up tomorrow, and joining us along with Ashley is Sarah Tafoya from the studio as well. Sarah, do you suppose Italy does better with St. Patrick's Day or with napping, as we were talking about earlier?
Oh, man. You know, I'm sure Italy is great at napping, so that's going to be difficult. I would love to hear what they're doing for St. Patrick's Day, because, you know, we know that St. Patrick was not actually Irish. He just went there. He felt compelled. God told him to go there and to preach to those people, and God bless him for doing that. So I would love to see what is Italy doing for this holiday.
Well, sure enough. And by the way, yes, we are very good at napping. We have a built-in nap every day at the riposo time as after lunch when things close down. But there will be a lot of celebrating on the feast of San Patrizio, as we say in Italy. First of all, there will be special masses at different churches that have an Irish affiliation. And in fact, at the Church of St. Isidore's College, the Irish community are going to do a nostalgic chorus of Hail Glorious St. Patrick. And then various pubs throughout the city will have specials on Guinness and different Irish bands, which will be playing. Even the Irish Club, of course, in Rome, there is an Irish Club, and they are going to host a three-course buffet meal, which includes an Irish Guinness stew and a traditional Irish dish of mashed potatoes with cabbage or kale, and then, of course, live traditional music. So, of course, Italians never miss an excuse to celebrate, especially their beloved San Patrizio.
You know, Ashley, we ask you about when kind of American holidays come up. And as far as St. Patrick's Day, it turns out, you know, kind of a bigger day in America often than even in Ireland as far as kind of secular celebrations. But you always let us know the Italians kind of, like you say, enjoy picking up on, you know, festivals that are kind of popular in pop culture around the world.
Oh, absolutely. The Italians, it's very important to the Italians to celebrate the Catholic faith with rich faith traditions. So that is why we see all of these wonderful excuses to celebrate these great saints. And most often, these celebrations usually involve food.
Another great celebration coming up, St. Joseph's Day.
Yes, indeed. St. Joseph's Day is actually Father's Day in Italy. So this is a very special day for families across the country. And indeed, as he is the patron saint of fathers and carpenters, as families come together, they will also celebrate again. In addition to celebrating with the Holy Mass, they will celebrate with special foods. And in Rome, it's the Beignet di San Giuseppe. So imagine that these are these fluffy puffs of deep fried dough. And in Rome, you'll find them filled with cream or ricotta, and they're just delicious. But not so far down in Naples, they'll be enjoying Zeppoli, which is similar piece of pastry that's either fried or baked and filled with cream. In Bologna and in Tuscany, a lot of times those same pastries will be filled with jam. But then in Sicily, their famous Sfincia di San Giuseppe, imagine that this is a colorful deep-fried pastry. It's covered with ricotta. It's decorated with chocolate and pistachio, with cherries and candied orange peel. But in Rome itself, one of the most popular stops on the Feast of St. Joseph is right there in St. Peter's Basilica at the altar of St. Joseph. So this is very near to the altar of the chair, so near to the front of the basilica. And this is the same place also where the remains of Saints Simon and Jude are too. And so people will come as a family with an opportunity to celebrate the Holy Mass there and to pray there, especially for their fathers and for fathers around the world.
Oh, that's so great that Father's Day combined with St. Joseph's Day. We think, wow, that kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And we really appreciate all the great food descriptions here on a random Thursday during Lent, if some might be trying to hold off. But feast days are coming. Hey, thank you so much, Ashley and Rona. Always a pleasure to get the latest from the Holy Father and on the food scene as well in Italy. Thank you so much. Blessed St. Patrick's and blessed St. Joseph's Day to you, too.
The same to you. So many blessings. So happy to be with you. Take care.
All right. Morning Air continues. We'll talk the spirit of St. Patrick in America with Joe Boland from Catholic Extension when we continue. New Story Corner coming up, too. It's all on the way here at Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Marching along in the big parade on St. Patrick's Day. I'll be up to me neck in shamrocks as I march along the way. I'll swing me old shillelagh as I wave to each colleen. I'll tilt me ear the better to hear the wearing of the green.
Oh, the Kelly's from Killarney.
That is excellent. A little Bing Crosby for you this morning here as we continue in St. Patrick's Week, celebrating early here on Morning Air as we continue on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app. Talking the spirit of St. Patrick in America, Joe Boland joins us from Chicago. He's Vice President of Mission for Catholic Extension. Joe, happy almost St. Patrick's Day. Great to have you along.
Thank you, Glenn. Happy St. Patrick, almost St. Patrick's Day to you as well on this beautiful almost Eve of the Eve.
There we go. Well, you know, we do like to celebrate. We do like to celebrate. The town I grew up in, St. Paul, Minnesota, used to have its parade right in the middle of the day at noon on St. Patrick's Day. And trying to do anything related to radio I could back in college, right? I was a club disc jockey for a bar and a restaurant right downtown, right on the parade route. And the night before, the deal was to take everything downstairs out of the area where people were dancing and enjoying. That included taking things off the walls as well as all the chairs and tables. And the party started, I think, about 10 a.m. the next day on St. Patrick's Day and went for, you know, a good 14, 15 hours. And that's how they did it in St. Paul. But we're going to talk about that spirit of St. Patrick beyond that partying spirit we might think about a little bit, but how that spirit, that love for one another, that service of St. Patrick has made a difference.
It really has. And I believe the spirit of St. Patrick is as strong as ever in many respects. And oftentimes we think of it as, you know, especially for me here in Chicago, we think about, you know, dyeing the river green and, mm-hmm. you know, the green beer and mashed potatoes and all that kind of stuff. But it really does push beyond that. And that, of course, is because of the fact that there is a large presence of Irish, many of whom are Catholic here in the United States. It's the second largest nationality in the U.S., according to the U.S. Census, behind only the Germans. So there's about 32 million Irish. And we think about them oftentimes in the big cities, you know, like St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Chicago, or on the East Coast, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. But we often don't think about the presence of Irish that went out to places like Silver Bow County in Montana, which is one of the counties that has one of the highest percentages of Irish people in the country. They were the miners. They went out there working the mines and stayed there and settled. Or they went out to be farmers as well. They went out to places like Shamrock, Texas, very appropriately named, you know, where they were sheep herders like they knew back on the old sod. And they went to places like El Paso. They were escaping some of that anti-Irish sentiment that was so prevalent, we know, in many of the larger cities of the United States. And they brought with them that spirit of St. Patrick. A Catholic Extension, since its founding in 1905, has built and repaired over 13,000 churches. And we know that hundreds and hundreds of them have been named St. Patrick. And so what we did this past year in our recent Extension magazine was follow some of these communities and look to see where the spirit of Patrick is still alive and well in our country today.
Well, those are some great stories to see some of the areas where there was great Irish influence. It's so funny, some of the discrimination. I was adopted back in the early 60s, and I remember revisiting my origins to see if we had any, when we were expecting a baby for the first time, if we had, you know, any idea of my medical history. And at that point, you know, things were closed up pretty tight, so they didn't know. But the conversation came up to the degree that my mom admitted finally that I was a little bit Irish. They'd never told me that before. I was 27 years old before I knew I was a little bit Irish, you know, and so I could wear green more authentically, I guess, on St. Patrick's Day. But, you know, kind of an odd quirk of American history, but yet that's there. What are some of the other towns that that influence is really happening in?
Well, they're really spread across the entire United States. And, you know, in every state, there is a presence of the Irish and certainly bringing their traditions of St. Patrick as well, especially when you think about the industries in which the Irish immigrants were getting themselves into, the railroads, you know, and as I said, mining. And when you're following the railroads, when you're following where the industry is, you end up all over the place. But the other phenomenon that happened as well is we saw the presence of Irish clergy and Irish religious coming to this country and following these Irish communities. And in fact, there was a missionary seminary, I should say, in Dublin called All Hallows College. It's where many of the Irish clergy who served in this country went. And you could still meet some of these folks. They're aging a bit, but proudly were part of this generation of missionaries who saw the United States as a mission country. And, it is said that in some states, in certain times of our history, the vast majority of secular clergy, of diocesan clergy, would have been from Ireland. So we're great beneficiaries, of course, of the faith that existed in Ireland that came to this country, both as the faithful, but also as the clergy as well. And so if you ever look through the rolls of clergy that have served this country, you notice there's a lot of Irish names. And we continue to see some of those wonderful priests and sisters who have done this great work. And they continue to be missionaries in our country. They often go to many of the dioceses that Extension, Catholic Extension, works with, some of the places where, the situation's very difficult. And we know that the Irish dedicated themselves as missionaries to help bring the faith alive in our own country here in the United States.
Boy, if we ever think we're struggling with, our tiny parish or our own efforts or whatever to spread the good news, to realize, look on the map, look at the size of Ireland, look at the size of America, but the Irish influence in America, especially with the faith, has just been huge and outsized, and, not without God's help and knowledge that's what needed to happen. And so that's absolutely great, absolutely great. Anything in particular that we can do a little better, maybe in addition to the partying for St. Patrick's Day, but to really think about, contemplate a little bit St. Patrick's work?
Well, I think you said it, Glenn, very well. Presence has been huge and outsized. And really, you have to think about St. Patrick as well as being a model of that. And so he's a model missionary. He's a model for us today as Catholics. Here's this young man who is taken. He's actually not born in Ireland. He's born in Britain. He's taken as a slave to Ireland. And he follows God's voice. He hears this voice inside of him that tells him to return to Ireland after he had escaped from slavery years ago. And he goes back as a missionary. And so many people are quick to point out that we don't know a lot of the details of the life of St. Patrick. But my response to that is, well, I think the results speak for themselves, that after St. Patrick, Ireland is clearly this very Christian country. And I think it's the way in which he went about his ministry. He's going to a people who he loves, a people who are considered barbarians. This was, the 5th century, and they were outside the Roman Empire. And they had a different way of thinking, and they had a different way of speaking. And Patrick said, I believe that the gospel should reach all peoples, all places, all cultures, all languages. And so he spoke to their unique Celtic sensibilities, their mystical sensibilities. He spoke to them in a way in which the gospel was firmly grounded in their culture, and that it stuck, and it has stuck for centuries. Again, not only in Ireland, but in the Irish diaspora who have come to this country. And so we are great inheritors of this one single individual who really heard the voice of God in a powerful way, responded to it, and had a massive, massive impact, not just in, the British Isles, in the North Atlantic, but indeed across the entire world. And so I think that's a great model for us to think about this St. Patrick's Day. What little can we do, and what great impact might that have for future generations?
Talking this segment of Morning Air with Joe Boland from Catholic Extension about the spirit of St. Patrick in America, constantly learning about St. Patrick's influence well beyond the Irish. Just yesterday, Joe was talking with the new bishop of St. Cloud, Minnesota, Bishop Patrick Neary, but talking about the time he served in Africa, and the people there had a great love, the Catholics that he dealt with in Africa, a great love for St. Patrick, because they could relate to the fact that he was held in slavery for a long time in his youth. And so they felt they could relate to that. And that was something, one of those, wow, I was today years old when I knew that. I learned that for the first time yesterday. So that spirit of St. Patrick alive and well in places we might not automatically assume. Hey, just a couple quick minutes left with you, Joe. I want to give you a chance to maybe let us know what some of the latest with Catholic Extension, some of the things that are happening.
Yeah, well, the work continues. The mission continues of Catholic Extension, building churches, supporting leaders, and supporting crucial ministries, especially in poor communities. Glenn, you mentioned that wonderful African community that adopts St. Patrick. We also are working with a community in Puerto Rico that is African descended. that is named St. Patrick. It's actually the oldest St. Patrick church under the American flag. It happens to be in Puerto Rico. It happens to be an Afro-Caribbean community, people who are descendants of slaves, who saw in Patrick this great patron because of his roots, but also because they prayed to him at one point. They were having also a famine of their staple crop, the yucca plants, just as the Irish did with the potato. And they prayed that St. Patrick would deliver them from this famine. And he did. And they adopted him as their saint. And the spirit of St. Patrick does live on well beyond the Irish. And this community in Puerto Rico is great evidence of that. And they're also great evidence of the fact that the faith continues to be alive in our country, especially in some of the most challenged areas and in some of the poorest communities. And that's precisely where we are working with Catholic Extension and very proudly working to help build up the Catholic Church so that it can serve not only this generation, but future generations as well.
Well, appreciate so much your time and good efforts, and always fun to find out more about the Irish. Joe Boland joining us with Catholic Extension. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk to Dave Durand, looking at common productivity mistakes and how to solve them. Dave, always great with success and leadership. Father Marcel Tyone coming up in a little bit, too, talking about Pope Benedict's advice for being a little holier every day. You'll find some good advice there. Not too late in Lent to pick up some new disciplines or kind of focus and bear down a little bit on what we'd like to be doing in the meantime. But first off, time for today's Story Corner. A story of encouragement today called I Don't Believe a Word of It, from Howard Hendricks. By the fifth grade, I was bearing all the fruit of a kid who feels insecure, unloved, and pretty angry at life. In other words, I was tearing the place apart. However, my teacher, Miss Simon, apparently thought that I was blind to this problem because she regularly reminded me, Howard, you are the worst behaved child in this school. So tell me something I don't already know, I thought to myself as I proceeded to live up or down to her opinion of me. Needless to say, the fifth grade was probably the worst year of my life. Finally, I was graduated for obvious reasons, but I left with Miss Simon's words ringing in my ears, Howard, you're the worst behaved child in this school. You can imagine what my expectations were upon entering sixth grade. The first day of class, my teacher, Miss No, went down the roll call, and it wasn't long before she came to my name. Howard Hendricks, she called out, glancing from her list to where I was sitting with my arms folded, just waiting to go into action. She looked me over for a moment and then said, I've heard a lot about you. She smiled and added, but I don't believe a word of it. I tell you, that moment was a fundamental turning point, not only in my education, but in my life. Suddenly, unexpectedly, someone believed in me. For the first time in my life, someone saw potential in me. Miss No put me on special assignments. She gave me little jobs to do. She invited me to come in after school and work on my reading and math. She challenged me with higher standards. I had a hard time letting her down. In fact, one time I got so involved in one of her homework assignments, I stayed up till 1:30 in the morning working on it. Eventually, my father came down the hall and said, "What's the matter, son? Are you sick?" "No, I'm doing homework," I replied. He kind of blinked and rubbed his eyes, not quite sure whether he was actually awake. He'd never heard me say anything like that before. What made the difference between fifth grade and sixth grade? The fact that someone was willing to give me a chance. Someone was willing to believe in me while challenging me with higher expectations. That was risky because there was no guarantee that an honor Miss Noah's trust. Everyone likes the end product of mentoring, especially when it yields a peak performer. The star athlete, successful business person, brilliant lawyer, impressive communicator. But how many of us want to deal with that person on the front end of the process? From 1 Thessalonians 5:11, therefore encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing. That's our Story Corner for today. You can listen to that again if you like or share it. It's available in podcast form, a couple spots on the Relevant Radio app and also on the Relevant Radio website. RelevantRadio.com. Both of those chock full of great Catholic info for you. Lots of stuff about Relevant Radio and great ways to stream the audio too. You can also access the Story Corner info in text and audio on the Glenn's Story Corner Facebook page. And we're also entertaining your suggestions. We try to be entertaining. And if you have an entertaining story, something you think that we would like, maybe something you've written, you can feel free to send that along too. The email is morningair@relevantradio.com, morningair@relevantradio.com. More of Morning Air coming up. Father Marcel Tyone, Dave Durand, and more next on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.